to edition 284 of the NRF1 podcast, Because Norfolk Knows, Formula 1. This is your F1 podcast straight out of Norfolk, UK. Well, sort of. Let's say Norfolk and Motorsport Valley, UK. Now, I have written here in my notes that I join you from the iconic Rushcutters public house on the outskirts of Norwich, but as I've just mentioned, this week we join you from the comfort of our own homes. So you may be wondering where our usual host, Rich, is this week. Unfortunately, he's fully booked, so you're stuck with me, Dan, and my brother Callum, as we bring you a Springer Brothers special this week, as we review the Italian Grand Prix and then look ahead to the Russian Grand Prix. So how are you, Callum?
Yeah, not too bad. You?
Yeah, good, thank you. Good. So the Italian Grand Prix, I think probably what we'll do is we'll start off with some of the news sort of preceding the Italian Grand Prix weekend. So let's probably get straight into it then. So George to Mercedes.
Yeah, I mean, that was a bit of a, well, I would say bombshell if we weren't expecting it for about the last 6 months, possibly longer. Yeah, I think that's probably what is really merited. I suppose what we've seen from Bottas previously is that he's constantly been given these one-year contracts and probably puts up enough of a fight, or, well, is competent enough without putting up enough of a fight against Hamilton to merit still being the number two rather than getting booted out. But I suppose this time Russell's caught enough of the eye for long enough into the season that Mercedes have just constantly stalled and stalled until Bottas has taken it on himself to say, right, I'm out of here, I want to move on to something else.
Well, do we think that it's a case of Bottas throwing the towel in, or is it more of a case of the fact that George has kind of been constantly on his shoulder since, well, I guess you could even argue since he won F2 in 2018, it's almost been a ticking time bomb in that sense, hasn't it? Especially given the happenings from the Sakhir Grand Prix last year.
Yeah, I mean, the writing's always been on the wall, really. We've always known that Russell's been nurtured since 2016 to be in that Formula One seat, assuming that he can showcase that he's got enough to really merit it, which we all know really for the last couple of years he probably has done. Really, I think Bottas has seen it coming, as he should have done, and noticed at a particular time, being now, that Mercedes have kicked the can down the road in terms of making a proper decision, to think that if he's going to stay in Formula 1, he needs to get out and needs to go somewhere else before Mercedes make the decision, before it's too late, essentially. So it's probably a little bit of both.
Well, the thing is with that, that if Bottas had thrown the towel in, for want of a better phrase, this time, well, probably not even this time last year, let's rewind the clock back to probably April, maybe even May time last year, then his options could arguably have been a lot more wide-ranging than they are this year, because he only really had the pick of Williams and Alfa, didn't he? Given we've got Sainz in Ferrari on a multi-year contract. Perez ultimately went to Red Bull after they decided they didn't want Alex in that second seat anymore. So he's almost done himself a bit of a disservice here, hasn't he, in trying to cling on for another year. But I guess you're probably then into the realms of the racing driver thinking. You know, you want to always be in the best car. And okay, he hasn't done a particularly great job this year. This is almost sort of reverting back to Bottas 2.0 or whatever it was in 2018. So, his unfortunate timing, I think, is probably the best way to put it, isn't it?
I think there probably wouldn't have been a good timing for him to get in another top seat anyway. If you look at last, really over the first lockdown, last spring, the main movers were probably, well, Vettel leaving Ferrari, and that sparked Sainz and then Ricciardo to move. Once you actually get into the season in 2020, the best place really to move probably would have been Renault, or to what is now Alpine anyway. Mm. So, I mean, well, other than that, it would be Red Bull, but whether or not they take him, who knows. In terms of him getting into another seat, I think the death knell had probably already rung well into last year, easily into this year. So for him to drop down into what theoretically probably ought to be a midfield team in Alfa Romeo is probably about where he ought to be. And I would dare say he's got the speed. Whether he's got it on a Sunday consistently is probably another matter. But for him to drop down into Alfa to be the team leader probably fits quite well the kind of driver that he is in terms of the talents that he's got.
Mm, especially at the stage of the career that he is now. You know, he's 32, I think I read earlier today. Mm-hmm. He's had nearly the best part of a decade in the sport. Perhaps it is about time that he takes on that number one role, because whilst he was at Williams, particularly in the early years of the V6 turbo hybrid era, he was with Massa, who was arguably the number one. Mm. And then since being stable with Hamilton. So perhaps this is going to be a nice new challenge for him, and especially given that since the news has broken, he almost seems like a different driver now. We're kind of on to Bottas 4.0.
Well, he was definitely a different driver in Monza, so I think a lot of the pundits really were saying, particularly Damon Hill, saying that as soon as you've got that assurance over where you're going to be, you just feel no pressure and you go up a level, I suppose. But for him, I mean, to go into Alpha, every team's got their cycle. They're probably at the lowest point of that cycle they've been for a while. Really ought to be coming back up to the top of it again soon. We've got new regulations coming in. Next year, he's going to be partnered probably with a rookie that will be a stopgap for a year before they put Porsche in the car. So it's, you know, for him to be the team leader in all of that, whilst hopefully they're going to bring a car that he can actually fight with, for him as a driver, I should imagine that's probably quite an exciting prospect. So I'm not really surprised that he signed for them with a multi-year deal.
Mm. Well, yeah, that multi-year deal is going to give him that extra security, really, isn't it? Because, like, as you already mentioned, he's been on one-year contracts for most of his career now. And that probably doesn't do much for your confidence, does it? If you're constantly looking over your shoulder, I'm sure those of our listeners who are contractors and do regularly work 6 or 12 months contracts, it's probably not a particularly stable environment to be in. It's not one that's envious, put it that way.
So, yeah, I think we'd probably all find it a lot easier if we were given 2 or 3 years, let's say, in something where you can just get your head down from the beginning, know that the work you're putting in right at the start is going to be a benefit to you right at the end, and kind of see where that takes you.
Mm. No, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk a bit more about this second seat at Alfa Romeo then. So obviously we know Bottas is going to be there for a few years, and you've already mentioned Porsche, but who do we think is going to be there next season? It could be Giovinazzi, obviously, but given his starring performance, or lack of starring performance at Monza, he's kind of a up and down driver, really, isn't he? He promised so much in F2, and in fact, I think it was even GP2 when he was there all those years ago, and since then he's not really materialised.
Yeah, I mean, he had a couple of races in, I think, 2017 at the start when he was replacing Wehrlein. looked okay, but was always a bit of an error-prone driver. And I suppose what we've seen since he's had the three years at Alpha, he hasn't really grown. I think he's probably had the speed on the Saturdays in the last couple of races and gone into Q3, but that's about it, really. In terms of, you know, being the full package, he's probably not there. So whether you'd want to keep him on as a stopgap is probably what quite likely he would end up being. If you're Alpha, I don't know how really attractive a prospect that would really be.
Yeah, so how do we feel about De Vries getting a one-year contract before potentially a promotion for table chair?
From what I've read, that's not how it's going to play out. I've not seen De Vries linked with that seat for probably a couple of weeks. And since then, Hülkenberger said he's not going to get it. And that's pretty much a certainty. What it seems to be to me is that Guan Yu Zhou is probably bringing about $30 million in terms of sponsorship, which if you're Alpha, obviously is going to be a lucrative prospect for a year, potentially. And the only other rival to it would be Giovinazzi, and even the Italian Automobile Association has asked the Italian government to provide some funding to help him get the seat back. So from what I can tell, it's probably between those two, and based on the fact that Joe has got his own sponsorship funding, he's probably the main protagonist to get the seat.
Well, Formula One itself, Formula One management is probably also rather keen to have Joe in that seat, mostly because he brings a new market, doesn't it? Well, I say a new market. Obviously, China has been around in the Formula One world since 2004, I think it was, the first Chinese Grand Prix was held.
Yeah.
So it's not a new market as such, but from a commercial point of view, and obviously seeing attendances from the previous few Chinese Grand Prix, it's not really been one that's a sellout event, has it? So let's say if we have a Chinese driver, it could bring that extra factor that pulls in a bit more money from China.
I suppose what really matters is that out of the Chinese drivers that have come before him, he's easily the best. And he'd probably say he's, you know, forgetting nationality, is probably quite capable to make a step up to Formula One. Considering that China's had in the past its main sort of staple drivers have been Ho Pin Tung and Ma Xinhua, to go from that to being, or to have potentially Guan Yu Zhou in the Formula One car would be, you know, that's a massive step up. So I suppose what we've seen with Verstappen is that we've had a good driver from a small nation. Suddenly it's like FIFA pitch all around Central Europe.
Exactly.
So if you're the Chinese government, you'd probably look at that and think, well, there's quite a lot of sport washing going on from states, be it, you know, Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern states. China probably aren't very far behind in terms of that with its involvement in the Premier League sponsorships. So, yeah, to get a Chinese driver in Formula One probably would be, I would imagine, quite high up on their list.
No, absolutely. Okay, so let's move on from Alfa Romeo then, if I've got a little bit of time. So last of the driver announcements I've got written down on my notes is Alex Albon to Williams. Now, this is one that I'm very pleased to see, and when the news broke, certainly put a smile on my face, because Alex is just one of those guys that you really want to do well. So glad to see him taking over George's seat, especially since seeing that Williams is now on the way up, or at least they've gotten a handle of the current philosophy, rather annoyingly in the last year of the rule cycle, as the Williams way, let's say. what do we think about Alex at Williams partnering Latifi?
It's probably the best they could have gone for, which is what we want to see. And it's, you know, I'm glad that Mercedes didn't get in the way of anything well, I say didn't get in the way of anything. Ultimately, he's gotten the seat, but apparently there are some very strict clauses in that contract that even Albon doesn't know about, I think, mainly regarding the intellectual property over the Mercedes engine, which you could probably understand, but I suppose really when you look at the other candidates, he, I should think, is the only one realistically who's got any proper experience in F1, considering that if it was down to Mercedes' pick, it probably would have been Nyck de Vries.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, given that Alex now has the 2 seasons worth of experience behind him, he's also coming from what is one of the championship contending teams. So he does bring that experience, especially from the simulator. He'll know the Red Bull car quite well, but and he may even bring some of the processes from Red Bull to Williams. So from a pure Williams point of view, from an independent viewpoint, that is kind of a no-brainer, as you say, really. So definitely pleased to see him in it. Whether they can produce a car next season that's again worthy of scoring points, it is going to be a question that we can only see in time. But yeah, I think it's good to see him get a second shot, and especially given that he's had a few exploits in DTM this year, and Red Bull have been very kind to him in continuing with his backing, and also the part of the announcement was that okay, he's broken his ties to Red Bull, but they are still loosely there. So I think from Alex's point of view, it's almost a no-brainer, isn't it? You can carry on with the Formula One dream, but also have the safety net that is Red Bull behind you. So even if things do go wrong for him, he's always got the backing of Red Bull, which that can provide him sponsorship should he decide he wants to go and do the Le Mans hypercars in WEC when we get all of the new entrance there. So even if it does go wrong in Formula One again, it's not the end of the world for him, is it?
I'd imagine what's probably happened is Red Bull have looked at Perez being his replacement. He was basically put in the car thinking, yeah, this is one of the most competent drivers on the grid. You know, he was better than the rest for, I think, 3 out of the 5 years before he joined Red Bull, including finishing fourth in 2020. So he came in it with pretty good credentials. We obviously knew that he was quite a good driver anyway. And he has probably not lived up to expectation in the sense that he's no closer to Verstappen really than Albon was. Whether that's something to do with the Red Bull itself or it's to do with the level of either driver, who knows? But I would imagine Red Bull have looked at it and thought, okay, maybe Albon and Gasly, in terms of their outright speed, are probably better than we gave them credit for. We dumped them both.
He's got the benefit of the doubt as such, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's good to see from Red Bull finally giving a driver a second shot that's not Danny Kvyat,
well,
where they're just
let's be honest,
playing.
Who else could they have thrown into that seat? I don't think really there are many others on the driver market that are as competent as Perez or have quite the same sort of standing, do they? So I think it almost makes sense really to stay put, doesn't it? Especially given we've got a new rule set next year and the fact that Perez joined in the last season of the current rule set and he can't change any of the design philosophy. So if he's getting the chance to equally put his stamp on next season's car, that might actually work more in his favour to retain that seat more longer term, because he's still quite young relatively, isn't he? He's got plenty of years left in him, and also the fact that from Red Bull management's point of view, Perez knows that he is the number two, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit like the Bottas situation, where that you've got an experienced driver that you know at least on his day could win you a Grand Prix,
It's the modern,
but you know,
Keller, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's just an experienced driver that, if you give him time, probably would be able to really ensconce himself in the team and hopefully get some decent results. I mean, if he ended up being exactly like Bottas, then you'd probably look back on his time and think, well, actually, that's quite an successful run as a number two. Which, I suppose if Red Bull are going to go down this line of they don't want to boot out Perez and get another experienced driver in from elsewhere, he's the only option. The only other option really is to boot out Perez, maybe promote Gasly again, and put in, or take a bit of a punt, maybe on Yuri Vips or Liam Lawson. Those are the only two that are in Formula 2 that could even have a hope in hell's chance of stepping up at the minute.
Yeah, it's a tricky one from a Red Bull Junior team, but so let's move on to the last piece of news that I want to talk about, and that is the engine discussions that took place over the Italian Grand Prix weekend, with the latest output of those being that VW Group may finally enter Formula One, and that might be as a partner with Red Bull Powertrains, and that is that would certainly be the most likely scenario, but it is possible that they would come in as a fresh entrant. So what do you think of VW Group entering with either Porsche or Audi brands?
I suppose it's been bubbling in the background for, well, years, really. I mean, I can't remember the first time that either of those two brands were touted with being in F1. Probably for about as long as I've been alive, frankly. But yeah, I suppose a step up would be long overdue. I mean, they've already cut back on, I think, on Formula E. I think both of them are leaving. I mean, you're the one that works in Formula E, so...
Yeah, well, Audi has already left, and they've decided they're going to go and do Dakar Rally. And Porsche, I believe, are staying in for the time being. They've already signed up to the Gen 3 regulations that start autumn of 2022. So we expect to see Porsche in Formula E for the next 3 to 4 years, potentially. So, yeah, I think... If it, from my point of view at least, it would most likely be Porsche if it was going to be one of the VW group. I don't think it would. I don't think it would be Audi. I think they're too busy doing other things. But I think the other point that we do need to know is that these new engine rules are due to come in at the start of 2026, and the main deal breaker for any of the VW group entrants potentially coming in either as a partner to Red Bull Powertrains or as a fresh entrant is the elimination of the MGUH, the motor generator unit heat, that effectively acts as a anti-turbo lag unit, and also contributes a significant amount towards the 50% plus thermal efficiency, which Mercedes in particular is very proud of. But one thing it does add is a lot of complexity, a lot of cost. And if you remember, I think it's 2017, the FIA did table a plan to scrap the MGU8 and also to try and simplify the current power unit, because at that point it was obvious that the spending had gotten silly. So I think it also seems that they want to try and get this in place again for the new engine regulations, whilst also increasing the electric power output from the MGUK. So we also need to consider, because obviously Formula One at the moment is clearly dominated by OEM and automotive manufacturers' demands. So definitely seems to me that the MGUH has had limited application on the road. I think Mercedes are the only manufacturer in Formula One at the moment who's utilised the MGUH, partly through the AMG Project One car, but I think some of the AMG models, if not now, but in the future, will have an MGUH attached to them. But Group Renault, for example, none of their powertrains have an MGUH, so you're almost at the whim of the OEM saying, look, this is such an expensive piece of kit that we can't use on the road. It's too Formula One centric, so let's get rid of it and welcome in a new partner.
I suppose somewhat of the upside of it as well, purely from a spectator point of view, is that I think the MGUH really plays its part in sort of quieting down the engine, plus also adds presumably a fair bit of weight. And that's, you know, something that's been constantly going up and up in recent years, is the sort of the weight or the lower weight limit. So if that's going to help bring it down, then, and also bring the noise up, then you'd hope that as a spectator sport, things will probably get a little bit better as well as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, given that we've been to Silverstone on a few occasions with the current engine regulations, and we were also lucky enough to go whilst the V8s were still around. And with the V8s, I distinctly remember you needed to have the foam earphones in, if not the over-ear ones. Probably were preferable, but with these, when we went to qualifying in 2016, you didn't need headphones. It was so quiet. You could quite happily sit there all day, and it was fine. And it was even the F2 cars were louder than Formula One back then, and they probably still are, to be honest with you. So maybe we need to bring back the effing V10s.
The thing that really stuck with me with the V8s was how, you know, when they went past, you could tell based on no other sense but how you felt, because the thing that's really stuck with me from V8s was how it felt like kind of my rib cage was being shaken from the inside out. But I haven't had that really since the V8s were no longer a thing.
Yeah, it is a shame. You do miss that visceral experience, don't you? It's only something
you've
gotten from that sort of Formula One engine, is the high-pitched screamers, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty unbelievable now to see the speeds that they can carry, especially through the high-speed corners, but the noise, in terms of what it was 10, 11 years ago, is just not quite the same.
Hello everyone, this is Jake Humphrey here. You're listening to the best Formula One podcast from the best county in the world, the NRF1 podcast. And I wasn't paid any money to say that.
No, I did give you some beers.
Okay, so we've kind of rambled on for, half an hour now about the news. So let's actually talk about the Italian Grand Prix. So shall we start with the elephant in the room?
I don't know what you're talking about.
The crash on lap 26, which was basically the main event of the entire race. So I think first of all we really need to get to the fact that the pit crews were considerably responsible for this, mainly Red Bull, who from what I understand fell foul of the new regulations that have been put in place to cause exactly something, not the two championship contenders take each other off at the first corner, but in trying to generate more human error. As I understand it, beforehand, pre-Belgian Grand Prix, when the nut was tightened, the gun would send a signal to the pit gantry that would then trigger a set of switches that would then, once all four of them and the jack was down, would turn the green light on. But now I believe the button to change direction from unlocking the wheel nut to tightening it, I believe there's also now a switch in there that now prevents you from automatically having that green light system in place. There's now a human reaction time in there that you have to press the button twice, I believe, now. So I think that's what Red Bull fell foul of. So we also have to consider the sprint race, which I think we'll come on to first. By no means this is a perfect format at the moment, especially given that FP2 is effectively null and void. But is this sprint race format doing the job that it was originally set out to do?
Well, I suppose the job that it was originally meant to do was to make more exciting racing, which, if you base it purely on the sprint races so far, it's, if anything, brought out the worst in what the racing is at the minute, which is just single file, pretty much.
Yes.
The most exciting bit comes
from the sprint race itself, isn't it?
And yeah.
Arguably, the sprint race's job is to spice up the race for Sunday, is it not?
It works in that sense to a degree. I mean, it gives you a chance to gain some places if you, you know, if you balls up on the Saturday, on the Friday evening in qualifying. But in terms of, you know, giving a platform of this is what Formula One is in terms of racing, on track racing, there isn't really any, because there's no strategy involved. So when you take out the strategy, ultimately, you're just left with what you're going to have to overtake on track on probably the same tyres, which when it comes down to that is, at the minute, not exactly the highlight of what the sport is.
Mm. So is it a coincidence then that the two sprint weekends we've had so far, the first one in Silverstone and now this weekend at Monza, have produced two rather exciting races?
Possibly. I mean, it depends on what you put it down to, because ultimately those two races boil down to the fact that the two championship protagonists, in one way or another, took each other out. Mm. So, you know, if it was Verstappen against Hamilton in Silverstone, yeah, okay, it might have been an exciting race, it might have been quite close, but if it were a repeat from the sprint race, and Verstappen wasn't taken out and just ran off into the wind, what we would have seen would have just been a complete procession. Mm. But we probably wouldn't have seen a lot in terms of actual racing between the two of them.
Yeah.
And in terms of Monza, it comes down to these moments involved in strategy, for example, where there's one factor or another that brings the two onto the same part of the track. And I suppose when you get the attitudes that both Verstappen and Hamilton have to racing, especially with each other, as title rivals, neither of them are going to yield to each other. So I think it's just one of those things where if you put those two on the same piece of tarmac together, there's probably half a chance that they'll hit each other.
Mm.
It doesn't really matter whether there's been a sprint race the day before or, you know, what any other circumstances are. I think it's just down to the fact that they happen to have ended up on the same piece of track at the same time and have tried to race each other for position, and probably in one sense or another possibly overstepped the mark.
Mm. Okay. So in terms of the sprint race, let's go back to that a little bit. Format changes. How do we feel about the current format? It's obviously not producing a very good sprint race itself, and as we just alluded to, the main race is kind of, perhaps a more dominated by the fact that we have had the two title contenders knocking each other off the road, left, right and centre. Do we think a reverse grid on a Saturday as a separate championship is going to be something that would give us exciting racing, or do we believe a reverse grid is against the ethos of Formula One?
It's definitely against the DNA in the sense that it's not something we've had before. So therefore, why would it fit in if it's something that's usually been more synonymous with something like Formula 2? I'm not completely against it having a place. I don't know how I'd feel about it being a completely different championship. You know, if it was like a sprint championship and a Grand Slam, as Stefano Domenicali has proposed, I mean, I personally, I'd be happy to go with it for a couple of years if it's, you know, 3, 4, 5 sprint races a season, and they get to sort of play around with what the format is, as long as it all feeds into, you know, ultimately the world champion being the world champion. Personally, I'd be happy to go along with it and see what the results are, because ultimately we're not going to know from 3 races over 1 year whether it's what we want to do going forwards, yeah, whether that will actually work with engagement. So it's as ever, it's one of those kind of trial and error things. Well, you know, if you've got an idea.
It's like that the knockout qualifier we had in 2016. That was a complete disaster. We didn't actually know that it was going to be a disaster until it was.
Yeah, exactly. It's like one of those things with knockout qualifying or aggregate qualifying from 2005, that if you don't have a few bites of the cherry, how do you know that you don't like it?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we'll have to table that then and see whether that comes true in the future, shall we?
Yeah, we'll see what they actually come up with, because they could probably, frankly, come up with a better idea for a sprint race than I can.
Yeah, and because, especially given the drivers themselves have been moaning about the current format. I think Norris was quite vocal over the weekend that the sprint race is somewhat lacking, especially given that everyone is basically conservative for want of not destroying the race on Sunday. So,
To be fair, if you had 3 Grand Prix a year and all of them were boring, would you say the Formula One is boring? Or would you say it's just something that you'd need more of to really gain more of a, you know, more of a decent data pattern, really? Because ultimately, the more of them you have, the more circuits you have them at, you're going to know a lot more easily what that format actually does for you. It might not be good, but at least then you can make a more informed decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so shall we actually move on to the elephant in the room, as I've just mentioned earlier on? So the crash itself, is the penalty for Verstappen justified? Or in fact, who was at fault, if anyone? Because the stewards have obviously decided that Verstappen is predominantly, in quotes, to blame, although a three-place grid penalty is actually somewhat of a... it's kind of a nothing penalty in the grand scheme of things, isn't it?
Well, considering that you would probably expect that if Verstappen's going to take an engine penalty at some point between now and the end of the season, you'd probably do it where you're being given a grid penalty anyway. So,
there has been a lot of talk that Red Bull were going to take a fresh powertrain for Sochi anyway, so if anything, that works into their favour, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't know about working in their favour, but if you've got a race where, you know, you just about render a penalty practically useless with some other penalty that you're going to take anyway, I don't think you'd be that bothered about getting the penalty. Mm. But if we go back to who was actually at fault, I can't say it was anything other than a racing incident.
Yeah.
If you look at...
I have seen others in our WhatsApp group chat have said that Verstappen, for them, was particularly to blame. But from my point of view, I have to agree, it is a racing incident, because they're both as stubborn as each other, and... The stewards have then said, okay, well, you're having this 3-place grid penalty because in the braking zone you were not alongside. But what they have, in my view, failed to really recognise is the fact that Hamilton has just come out of the pits. Of course, Verstappen is not going to be alongside because they weren't racing the lap prior.
Yeah.
At least not directly. So, you know, you have to... They've tried to consider that full chicane, those two corners, as one, which in my view is completely wrong. But either one of them could have given room for me. Verstappen, yeah, definitely, you do have grounds to say he couldn't make that corner by charging in like that. But equally, in the F2 race, or one of the F2 races over the weekend, a very similar incident happened. Okay, one driver wasn't coming up the pits, but one driver, I think it was Ralph Boschong, overtook on the outside, or tried to overtake on the outside towards turn one, which then gave him the inside for turn two. And the driver who was on the inside for turn one and subsequently outside for two ended up giving space because they saw the lunge. But is Hamilton ever going to do that? Probably not. But if you really think about it in hindsight, okay, we are looking at it with hindsight, that he's just come out of the pits on the medium tyre. Max is on the hard. Why not give him the space? You're likely to get a better run with the slipstream through Curva Grande and get him back at the next corner, if not the next lap. So is this not a problem of driver pride?
Possibly. I mean, to be honest, if you look at the precedent that's been set, going right back to the start in Imola, Verstappen basically made the decision that he was not going to yield to Hamilton for any reason in an overtake or a potential overtaking move. And that's kind of set the tone for every time they've been in a direct battle on track every time for the rest of the season. And when that happens in such a fierce rivalry between two fairly equal drivers in equal machinery that are going for the world championship, you know that neither of them are going to back down. You know that they both want to win absolutely equally. And you can see, because in the 360 video that Formula One released from Hamilton's car, you can see quite clearly that he's looking in his mirrors going into, on pretty much on the exit of turn one, positioning himself for turn two. There's no way that he doesn't know that Verstappen's there. So it's a little bit of a case of if you wanted to say that in Silverstone at Copse, Verstappen knew that Hamilton was there and still decided to turn in, that's exactly the same principle that you can apply to turn two. In both instances, they knew that they were there, decided to take the risks, and ultimately they've come out worse for wear on the other side of it. I can't really apportion blame to either driver over the other, because ultimately Verstappen's made that move. It's probably a little bit desperate, but he's got to make it. After Silverstone, it was all these Hamilton fans saying, oh, if you don't go for a gap, you're no longer a racing driver. Well, same goes here.
Verstappen has to make that move, doesn't he? Because he is inherently at a disadvantage. So from Verstappen's point of view, yes, you are going to have to go for it. But for me, Hamilton maybe should be thinking a lot smarter than that, especially given that he can see where Max is. Is that a lack of racecraft, do we think? From a 7-time world champion?
I think you could probably make a case for it, potentially. I don't think that's necessarily it. I think all it boils down to is just that they're two elite sportsmen, that the precedent is that neither of them are going to give an inch. So why start now when it comes into, pretty much into crunch time? And from Verstappen's point of view, you can't not go for that gap, considering that he was in a fortuitous position anyway before the pit stop, and that all of a sudden he's lost it. You're not going to think, oh, well, I'll take third or whatever fourth behind Hamilton. They both want to win, and why, who can say that in their position, either their positions, that if you're faced with that kind of a challenge, you're not just going to go for it? Why would you want to go for anything other than win when the championship, especially at the minute, is as close as it is?
Yeah, well, talking about the championship, so Max has actually come out of this weekend better off on the weekend that it was looking like Mercedes were going to either close the gap between the two title contenders or even have Hamilton retake the lead of the Drivers' Championship. So if you're Red Bull, you're laughing, aren't you?
Yeah, you probably are, to be fair. I suppose if you had offered Christian Horner to be, 5 points ahead now?
Yeah.
Or 4 points? You would have absolutely taken that.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So we'll leave the elephant in the room there, and we'll actually get on to McLaren's first win since Brazil 2012, their first 1-2 since Canada 2010, both of which I believe, were they both Jenson Button wins? I know Brazil 2012.
No.
No, was it?
Brazil was, but Canada was won by Hamilton.
Yeah, okay. So, a decade of hurt. It's not quite 6 years of hurt, but a decade of hurt for McLaren has finally culminated in their first 1-2 for 11 years. And I have to say, I do feel rather sorry for them, because the win and the good news for them has come rather under the blanket of the crash on turn one. So what do they have to do to grab the headlines a bit more? Okay, but you just have to be so overjoyed for them, but a little bit gutted for Norris on a weekend where the win was there for the taking, and Ricciardo struggling up to this point. It's almost like he's come back from the summer break completely refreshed and ready to take the fight to Norris. So my heart kind of goes out to Lando, really. He really should have won that race if you look at the rest of the season, but Ricciardo definitely earns that win.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, if you look at particularly where Ricciardo has struggled, it's been in predominantly braking zones and how that affects him for the rest of the corner. So to go to fundamentally probably the braking track on the calendar at the minute and not really look at all fazed by Norris for either of the races pretty much all weekend, you can't not say that he absolutely deserves that. To be where he was and go away over the summer, clearly had some kind of a reset or something like that, and has just come back and gotten the ultimate prize. No, I don't think anyone really expected it. I think going into the weekend, if you'd said there's going to be a McLaren winner, everyone and their dog would put their money on it being Norris.
Yeah, absolutely. That certainly would have been my bet. But given that, as you said, we've kind of had the king of breaking tracks in Monza, Sochi is another one. So given that we've now got two back-to-back, do we think Ricciardo can take that to the next level, or at least stay where he was for this weekend going into Sochi?
I suppose his aim has always got to be, well, you always aim to be ahead of your teammate. But if he can reach the levels that we think that Norris has been reaching all season and stay there, I think Ricciardo's stock will go right back up to where it was probably at the start of 2018, really, when it looked like he was a proper top driver in F1, being one of the sort of more preeminent figures, you know, mentioned in that same vein as sort of Hamilton and Verstappen and Vettel at the time. So going into Sochi, if he can at least carry that on, that's got to be at the very least his aim.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely, especially given the timing for next season. I should imagine McLaren were probably thinking, God, what have we done? We've only got to make a mistake here, but yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, he has been struggling on the break, so hopefully for them, they can modify some of their process to sort of mitigate against that and combine it with Daniel's newfound confidence on the brakes in that McLaren. So, yeah, it's only looking up from here, isn't it, hopefully?
Well, yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, I suppose it always takes a little bit of time for the majority of drivers to adjust from, you know, well-founded processes that they've been used to for a few years to a brand new team, a brand new car. So, especially when that car doesn't suit the way that you want to drive, it must be particularly difficult to be, you know, when marginal gains are king, it must be unbelievably difficult to go from, you know, struggling to score points in some races to the track where your weakness should probably be exposed the most, and then ending up ahead of your teammate pretty much all weekend at the vital moments and winning.
Yeah, it's been quite the rise. Okay, so a couple more points on the Italian Grand Prix before we do our of the weekend awards. So the first point I have down in my notes is Alex Jakes came out with a very interesting stat on the Channel 4 coverage over the weekend that the Monza pole position is more valuable than Monaco.
Presumably in terms of conversion from pole to race win, right?
Precisely, yes. Which I thought was quite incredible, really. It's definitely not a stat that I ever thought was on the cards from me. Without actually having looked at the numbers, I always assumed that Monaco would have been king of that one. But I thought that was very interesting for sharing. The next point I have is R. George. He got very lucky under the safety car. He managed to vault a few places, and it doesn't seem that he can stop scoring points now since he broke his duck with Williams.
But it's almost a little bit like... I was going to say it's a bit like Sachin Tendulkar when he was, you know, constantly going on about the 100th hundred. That he waited for however long it was to get, about a year or something. I don't know, I'm not really that into cricket, but but if anything, that's probably a little bit like Hamilton's run to win number 100,
yeah,
considering that he's...
aren't we? And London and buses also comes to mind.
Wait 3 years for them and three of them come along in four races?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they've finally gotten on top of the car. It's nice to see that they're actually competitive, and also to the point where, okay, maybe you might have grounds to say this wasn't on merit per se this weekend, perhaps they did luck into it, but there is also an element of the fact you do make your own luck, and also that they are now competitive enough to be in a position to pick up the pieces from other people's misfortune. So good to see them scoring points consistently, and also kind of barring another shock result, you would probably say they're quite comfortable to hold off Alfa Romeo for eighth in the constructors this season.
And it's probably not even just a George Russell thing either, because I think Latifi was running in the points for quite a lot of that race, and you know, was in Belgium, was pretty high up as well in Hungary. So it's the fact that both of them are scoring points. I mean, yeah, okay, George has taken the headlines, and probably rightly so. But even as... I mean, when Latifi came into F1, I thought, well, he's just a pay driver. You know, he spent whatever it was, 4 years in Formula 2 and still didn't manage to win a title, with his best finish being second. Is that really the kind of record that you would expect of a driver that's going to establish themselves? But in fairness to him, he's probably got the opportunity to go and do it now.
Yeah, well, he's definitely giving George more of a run for his money this year than he was last, especially since that Hungarian Grand Prix. So I think it bodes well for next year, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to see Latifi alongside Albon, I think that'll be probably one of the more interesting lineups, really, to see both of those two going at it. Seeing, hopefully...
I believe, actually, if I remember rightly, were teammates at Dams in Formula 2.
When was that? Was that 2018? Must have been 2018. Yes. Yeah, I think they were, actually.
So they have got previous.
Well, at least they know each other and how they work, so that can... You would hope, if they could work together, that should be a good thing for the team.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we've now been rambling on for about 55 minutes now, so we'll have to do the of the weekend awards. So let's start with the Rodolfo Gonzalez driver of the weekend. Who do you think? Who's your money on?
I don't suppose you can really give it to anyone other than Ricciardo, for the reasons that we've already gone over. I suppose the only other candidate, if we're going to play devil's advocate, is probably Bottas 4.5.
Yeah, that was going to be my other suggestion. Coming through from... was he actually dead last on the grid? I think he was, wasn't he?
19th.
Yeah.
Well, it was the last of those that started on the grid.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, yeah. So, and then he got through to on the podium, and he gave us that lovely moment of unfortunate.
That and somehow evading the shoey again.
Oh, I don't know how he managed that. Did you see the post-race press conference?
I've seen the sort of little argument that they had over the shoey.
Yeah, that's
but apart from that, I haven't seen any of it.
Yeah, if any one of our listeners hasn't seen it yet, I definitely urge you to try and find it. It's a nice little video.
One day we will feed the Finnish man his toe jam.
Yeah. Okay, so Team Lotus, team of the weekend. For me, it has to be McLaren, really. I think that's the obvious one.
Yeah, realistically, you can't really give it to anyone else. It's definitely not Red Bull, is it?
No.
So, yeah, we can go with McLaren.
Okay. Aston Maldonado of the weekend.
Should we say the wheel gun man that didn't press his OK button?
Well, that's
or whatever
a good shout, actually. Yeah, OK, well, we can go for that. My other shout was a bit more left field, ignoring the elephant in the room, would be AlphaTauri on their home Grand Prix, or one of their home Grand Prix. They've already had one this year. somehow managed to balls it up, and I think they both had... They both had retirements, didn't they, Gasly and Tsunoda. So that would be my left field shout. Okay, Giuliano Salvi moment of the weekend. That much has to be obvious as well, doesn't it?
I think in terms of memeability and cultural impact, you can't really give it to anything other than unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah, that was going to be mine, yeah. Okay, so that's the Italian Grand Prix sort of more or less wrapped up. So let's talk a little bit about the Russian Grand Prix before we leave you. So yeah, we're going from one of the crown jewel events in the Formula One calendar to what is objectively one of the worst races. So we've already spoken a little bit about some potential engine penalties for Verstappen, especially given that he's given that three place. Grid drop. And normally this is actually a Mercedes stronghold, but I wonder how Red Bull are going to do this year, given that actually on a number of circuits that have traditionally been strong Mercedes circuits, Red Bull have actually kind of taken a fight to them, especially could even say at Monza, where historically, Red Bull have really struggled, even when they were dominating in the early 2010s.
Yeah, it does kind of feel a little bit like, you know, what it feels like to me is a little bit reminiscent of 2011 and 2013 in particular. In 2013, if you look at Red Bull's wins, they won in Canada, which they never had before. They won in Monza as well, which they hadn't won. Apart from 2011, hadn't won at all, and they won in Spa as well. So they've won at pretty much all the low downforce circuits on the calendar. You have to look at, I suppose, when it comes down to the kind of David versus Goliath. Let's say, if you can really break your rival's stronghold, you'll probably end up winning the title if everything else comes together for you.
Yeah, it's like winning away from home in football, isn't it? Once you start clocking up the away wins, and if you can combine that with the results at home as well, you're in with a very good chance of winning a given title, isn't it? So, I think given Red Bull have taken the fight to them this year, it's definitely increased that sort of tension, hasn't it? And more so than, well, in fact, I was going to say that this title fight almost reminds me of the 2007-08 title fights when we had McLaren and Ferrari so closely matched. But I think even then, those two championships were had actually a lot more swing to them, depending on, the relative strengths of the cars. Whereas this year, it almost seems like both of them are equally matched on a given type of circuit, and the nuance is actually even more nuanced than previous examples.
Yeah, I can't really think of a championship year where both of the cars from two top teams have been so well matched from pretty much every manner of circuit that they go to. So in terms of, you know, whether you want it balanced on a knife edge the whole year, this is probably, you know, the championship for that.
Yeah, and it's a shame that we're getting a championship fight like this in the last year of a rule set before inevitably the reset comes over the winter this year, and then we get a lot more field spread. It's almost the way of Formula One, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, you have to hope that really, with this change, I suppose, in philosophy, that that well, they're going to move away from this sort of
actually that the field spread, or any potential field spread, is offset by the fact that if there are two close rivals, or two cars, or however many cars close together on track, that they can actually overtake. So the races themselves might actually be more entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose when we think of that, what I think of is probably 2011, when the racing actually itself was quite good, but the championship was quite one-sided towards Red Bull. But I suppose if they're going in this direction where ultimately they've got this philosophy in the design of the regulations that they know works for the sake of racing, everything else about, you know, being closely matched from one team to the next, that will all come about within 5 years or so anyway. Yeah. So assuming that we're out of this cycle of constant, you know, changing of regulations and massive resets every few years, hopefully in the longer term, that should stand the sport in quite good stead.
Well, one can but hope at this point. Okay, so, yeah, my last point that I have on the Russian Grand Prix, because honestly, I have struggled to compile a list of notes for anything good to talk about, is that this is potentially one of the remaining few races that we will be having at Sochi before it moves venue.
Isn't it to St. Petersburg?
I believe it is. I can't actually remember the name of the circuit, but I know that it's being freshly constructed for the Grand Prix, or at least being revamped. Because I'm pretty sure DTM actually has done a few races there previously, so actually if any of the listeners do want to have a look, I'm sure on YouTube somewhere there might actually be some video of the circuit, so we can kind of get a good idea of what that might be like. But hopefully it will be better than Sochi, because Sochi is, for want of a better word, absolutely dire.
Without getting the beat machine out.
Yeah, we are trying to save Rich a bit of time on the editing of this.
I'll have a look. I'll see. No, not that St. Petersburg. I don't want the IndyCar track. I'm just Googling to see if I can find what that track actually is. Because I'm not sure, because you bring
it Agora Drive or something like that.
Yeah, it is Agora Drive.
Ah.
So that is an existing racetrack.
Ah, okay.
I didn't know that. When you mentioned DTM, I thought that was Moscow.
Was it? Okay.
It was opened in 2019, and its major events include the Russian Grand Prix from 2023 onwards.
Okay, so this is going to be the penultimate Russian Grand Prix at Sochi.
Well, I don't think it will get a very fond farewell into 2022, will it?
No, probably not.
But other than that, it looks like the other events have been DTM and World Rallycross.
Okay. So actually, one point I've just come up with is that it will be the home Grand Prix, but not the home Grand Prix of He Who Shall Not Be Named.
The racing egg.
Yeah, he races under a white flag, so...
Appropriate, considering that he finished last half the time, or and, retires.
And the, as DT sent in the group chat earlier on, he's 21st in a 20-car championship. Which is,
yeah, that did entertain me.
Yeah, that does complete the lot, really, doesn't it? Okay, so my final point before we leave you is, if you haven't done so already, and you actually have access to Netflix... You really need to watch the Schumacher documentary. I watched it last night, and considering that I'm of the age where I grew up with Michael Schumacher being Formula One, essentially, that kind of brought a few tears to the eye, especially when they were talking about his skiing accident and his first title win with Ferrari in 2000. It was interesting to see how he grew up and how he even got into Formula One. I personally knew a little bit about his kind of rise through some of the junior ranks, but I didn't realise that about his karting career. That was quite an interesting story. So if you haven't done so already, yeah, highly recommend that. I'm sure you probably also recommend it as well, Callum.
Yeah, to be honest, I think it was probably the best Formula One documentary that I've yet to see.
It's on a par with Senna. If anything, Senna is perhaps a little bit more biased, I think.
Yeah, they totally glossed over, for example, Suzuka 1990, where, you know, he pretty much deliberately took out Alan Prost to win the title. Whereas in Schumacher, they do go over, I mean, you could argue that 1994 was a little bit glossed over, but they still had Damon Hill talking about it. You know, they didn't kind of take the easy route in telling the story. Let's say that. They did really go for sort of the full picture as much as they could in a 2-hour window, which, you know, considering that they kind of glossed over the last Ferrari championships after 2000... they really got to the whole story as a, you know, as the good and the bad. It wasn't particularly a biased story from what I was seeing from it anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So before we leave here, I'll just let you know that there are lots of ways to get in touch with us at the NRF1 podcast. For our social media, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And the handle for those, for all three of those, is @thenrf1. Or you can email us. The email address is nrf1podcast@gmail.com. Okay, so thank you for joining me this evening, Callum.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and we shall see you after the Russian Grand Prix for edition 285.